police force in every city, in every county, in every state in the United States. All of this has to be resisted, has to be criticized, has to be attacked for what it is, which is really a defeat of civil liberties and civil rights in the United States. Thank you all very much. You stay tuned. KBOO brings you the truth, and it will do it over and over again as long as you help us keep on the air.
This is a man's world, but it wouldn't be nothing, nothing without a woman or a girl. You see, man made the car to take us over.
KALU Community Radio and Triangle Productions are proud to co-sponsor the return of Medicarefully Fabulous. Friday, August 8th through Saturday, August 16th, Medicarefully Fabulous will return to the Sanctuary Theater for a limited engagement. The show is a series of original stories about aging, faith, friendships, and recovery. Again, that's Medicarefully Fabulous, Friday, August 8th through Saturday, August 16th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at KALU.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Registration is now open for the Pacific Northwest Social Forum coming to Portland the weekend of September 26th through the 28th. The weekend will feature People's Movement assemblies on topics such as treaty rights, food sovereignty, housing justice, and more. The Social Forum will begin Friday, September 26th with the concert by KBOO Station co-manager Mike Crenshaw and friends. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this important and historic event where we, the people, will create the Pacific Northwest Plan of Action for social, economic, and climate justice. Information about registration, endorsement, childcare, or on the Pacific Northwest Social Forum in general can be found at KBOO.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're tuned to KBOO Portland. We've got public affairs programming coming up for you for the next several hours, beginning with Veterans Voice, today providing a forum for veterans and their supporters to speak about war and its effects. Today, Sarah Bining is the guest, and she's from the Iraqi Veterans Against the War, and she's on their board of directors. Bill, Angie, and Marvin will be speaking with her today. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 10:15, hear Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein, featuring an interview about big oil and U.S. foreign policy in Iraq. At 11 o'clock, it's Sojourner Truth Radio from our sister station KPFK in L.A. The shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, protests on the street, and the military-style police response brings to light decades of racial hostility. And we'll discuss a lot of issues around that. Today's guest on Sojourner Truth Radio will be Dr. Gerald Horn, who was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri. Thanks, KBOO members, for your great support. We really appreciate it. And if you're not a member, you can certainly go to kboo.fm and become one by clicking where it says Donate Today. Okay, here comes Veterans Voice. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO this morning.
We bomb everywhere, man. We bomb everywhere. Way more than our share, man. We bomb everywhere. We bomb the mountains bare, man. Found the desert air. Oh boy, don't we care, man. Cause we bomb everywhere. We've bombed in Peru, Panama, Pakistan.
Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, and Laos, Syria, Sudan, Congo, Cuba, Korea, Kuwait, Colombia, Cambodia, ain't we great? Grenada, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Vietnam, Yugoslavia, El Salvador, Afghanistan, Japan, Bosnia, Somalia, Indonesia, Iraq, China, Iran, time to attack, yeah, we bomb everywhere, way more than our share. Don't think we ain't fair, cause we'll bomb everywhere. We got family values and moral majority, peace, love, Jesus, top priority. Do unto them for they do unto us, the kingdom come in nuclear dust. Monumental profits are being made for the big shareholders in the old arms trade. They lust for the dust of a mushroom cloud. It's making them all American proud. Yeah, heat seeker, bunker buster, Daisy Cutter, napalm, phosphorus, uranium, smart bomb, A-bomb, predator, prowler, raptor, raven, tomahawk, hellfire, flags are waving. We bomb everywhere, way more than our share. Oh boy, ain't we fair, cause we'll bomb everywhere. Our vision of peace has become a ghost, but we're number one, we bomb the most. Soldiers coming home suicidal, we sit and watch American Idol, Saudi, Serbia, Mexico, Kosovo, Romania, Germany, load them up, here we go, another reverse. Life gets worse, just watch your show and wait for the glow. Well, someday soon I'll have nukes, true world democracy. Extermination of all life, high possibility. Well, ask your child what they suggest to prevent mass destruction and bring this world in line with love and a brotherhood connection. De-escalate your mental state, incinerate your tools of hate, build no more weapons or rejuvenate our planet's fate. Drop food, medicine, clothes and tools the children wish you'd see, that will win most the hearts and minds before you count to three. Then we'll bomb everywhere, man, way more than our share. Don't think we ain't fair, man, cause we'll bomb everywhere. We'll bomb in Peru, Panama, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, Laos, Syria, Sudan, Congo, Cuba, Korea, Kuwait, Colombia, Cambodia, ain't we great? Grenada, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Vietnam, Yugoslavia, El Salvador, Afghanistan, Japan, Bosnia, Somalia, Indonesia, Iraq, China, Iran, time to attack.
Welcome to Veteran Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, and 100.7 FM Albany, Corvallis, Eugene. Or you can hear us streaming on the web at kboo.fm. And if you want to hear some of our older shows, you can go on the web at kboo.fm/Veterans Voice. Veteran Voice, one word. I'm Marvin, along with Mr. Bill.
Good morning.
And Angie.
Good morning.
And today we're going to be talking with Sarah Bining, who is on the board of directors of Iraqi Veterans Against the War. And we just I wanted to say happy birthday to our buddy Joe Lewis. Joe Lewis is a good friend of ours. Joe Lewis was one of the students who was shot at Kent State back in 1970.
Happy birthday, Joe.
Hey, Joe, happy birthday, and I hope you're doing well. And also want to say, you know, how much we stand in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Ferguson, Missouri, over the shooting of the young black man, Brown, and how horrible it is. We've been talking for years and years about how the police are being militarized and wearing military uniforms and carrying military guns and wearing and having APCs and armored personnel carriers and everything around them on when they're supposed to be police and not a military standing army in our neighborhoods. And I'm glad that that's being brought out about what's going on in Ferguson. And here in Portland, remember, Bill, back a few years back where they used that armored personnel carrier?
Oh, yes.
And threw the guy
on the back,
on the back of it?
Yeah.
And drove him out?
Yeah.
And so we have that here in Portland. And if at our rallies here in Portland, those military policemen have been right there.
And those military vehicles.
And those military vehicles. So we got them right here in Portland, too.
You bet.
And they're just horrible. There's no reason for that stuff to have. They're supposed to be police. There's a definite line between an occupying force, which, you know, these military cops are, that's an occupying force in a police department, and there's got to be an end to that. That's just nonsense to have that. the George Bush is. Do you guys feel the same way I do, Sarah and Angie and Bill, that George Bush is getting off? He's not being held accountable for what he did, for starting all this mess in Iraq and Afghanistan and all those places. He's not being charged at all. He's sitting back. He's, you know, he's getting away with murder. That's what he got away with.
Much of the information that they used to get us into this lousy war was produced by a person by the name of, with the nickname Curveball.
Yeah.
And Curveball had some background that wasn't too legitimate.
Right.
And the speech that Colin Powell made in the United Nations, where he shook that bottle of powder around,
right.
much of that speech was gleaned from Curveball's information, which was not very reliable.
It was not reliable at all. And George Bush is not being held accountable.
No.
George Bush, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld, and all those people who caused this mess in the middle in Iraq and Afghanistan are not even, you know, they even go on television and talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, and they've never ever said, you know, well, we messed up. They never say that, you know.
And, in fact, they made a bunch of money.
They made a whole bunch of money, especially Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
You know, and so they don't, they're not being held accountable for what they did. And when Barack Obama, the president, got in office, he says, we look forward, we don't look back, you know. Look at all the dead people in Iraq.
Well, Nancy Pelosi did a number on it, too, didn't
Nancy
she?
Nancy Pelosi did, too.
She said that wasn't going to be on the table.
It wasn't on the table. That they got away with, you know, starting this whole thing, the violence that's going on.
Over yeah.
There. And they are just as guilty as anything.
And if they say it ain't about the oil, it's about the oil.
There's no doubt about the oil. It's about the oil. And so, you know, I just makes me mad, you know, that they're getting off. And
well, we use the resources and the youth of our nation for a military force in order to keep control of the natural resources in that part of the world.
Oh, yeah, that's what this is all about. That's all it's all about. And we have somebody here who can talk about that. We have two people here that can talk about it. So you want to go ahead and introduce Sarah, and we'll get going here.
Well, we have today my really awesome person, Sarah. And she, her story is very interesting. And it's something that I couldn't even afford to not have her talk about today if she was willing to do that. And I haven't really talked to anybody who is actually AWOL before, but your story isn't just you were mad and then all of a sudden you decide, you know what, screw it, I'm leaving. That's not even how it happened, which is kind of what I assumed, and it wasn't that way at all. It's actually a very intricate, complicated story that took a lot of time to even unfold to where how you're sitting here right now. And so you ended up joining the military and were deployed to Iraq in 2005, Christmas 2005, is that right?
Yeah, I was deployed in Christmas of 2005, and I was there until just after Thanksgiving of 2006.
Mm-hmm. And so when you were in the military, what exactly did you do?
I was an intelligence analyst with 4th Infantry Division. I worked in G2, which is current intelligence operations, and I actually worked in current intelligence operations in Multinational Division Baghdad, which oversaw everything that goes on in Baghdad, as well as receiving reports from everything that happened outside of Iraq. And that was my job. I did the body count every day with multinational forces and coalition forces who'd been killed. And I also did work on the tip line that was call-ins from the Iraqi people, as well as working on IED safety on our routes.
And so you ended up probably seeing some pretty horrific things.
It's funny because I'll never say that I left the wire, which is a big point of contention for a lot of people. It's like, oh, well, you didn't go outside the wire, so you didn't see a bunch of crap or whatever. But we actually, the way we operated in Baghdad was that we had blimps and UAVs, which we called them UAVs then. We didn't call everything a drone, but that's essentially what it was. We had a bunch of UAVs and blimps and even like street corner cameras all across Baghdad. And so we watched everything that happened live on television. You know, you watch people dying, watch people getting blown up, but on television so you can have a good sight picture, but you don't actually get to go out and be able to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I never heard about having a tip line. Talk about the tip. Angie, do you
know? No, I have no idea.
I don't know. Talk about that. I have no idea what that is.
You know, honestly, it was, I feel like in my personal experience, it seemed to be something that was more like a public affairs related boon to the Iraqi people as opposed to something we actually acted on. We would, the U.S. military coalition forces ran a tip line in Baghdad where the Iraqi people could call in and say, hey, you know, I saw this guy plant a bomb, or hey, there's like this going off in a marketplace or whatever. They could call and, you know, give us tips. Mm. But it took an average of 12 hours or more for the U.S. military to act on any of those tips.
Well, so kind of.
So
do you think that was more of a PR thing?
Yeah, I really do. Just based on the way we acted on it. I think it might have started out as like a good idea, but it was never acted on in a timely manner, in a way that would make it functional, at least at the division level that I worked in.
Be a good way to get rid of your neighbor, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and that was probably another thing, too, is that not all the tips were valid, even if we had gotten to them in time. But.
Yeah, kind of like the Phoenix program in Vietnam. The Phoenix program was basically the same thing, you know? So people would squeal on their neighbors, or if they wanted something somebody had, they would say, well, they're Viet Cong. Mm-hmm. You know, and the Phoenix program was such a horrible thing that they killed just so many innocent Vietnamese, you know, kind of like a tip line like this. Mm-hmm. So not good.
So you ended up getting deployed to Iraq and everything, but how did you actually end up in the military to begin with?
Yeah.
Why did you join? What made you kind of make that leap?
Well, that's always the million dollar question, right? Like, why did you end up in this situation?
It's always very interesting, yeah.
What did you do? Mm-hmm. I was actually in junior ROTC in high school.
Oh, poor girl. Sorry.
Well, I wanted to get out of gym class, so and a bunch of my friends were going
from
into
the frying
it.
Pan.
Stupid gym class. But I had the NCOIC of the junior RTC program was this really amazing special forces sergeant, or retired special forces sergeant, that was a really caring person. Like the whole community, the whole program was like a family full of, it's like the Island of Misfit Toys, except it was high school kids. And so after high school, I was really not making a lot of good decisions in my life. I wasn't going in the direction that, you know, I thought would be a good thing. And I wanted my parents to be proud of me. Mm-hmm. So I signed up for the military thinking that it would be like my NCOIC from the junior ROTC program. And it'd be a bunch of family and, you know, I'd mm-hmm. have some direction. And the recruiter told me that if I became an intelligence analyst, then I wouldn't need to deploy to do my job. That's technically true.
Yeah.
I won't need to deploy to read reports, but they deploy you to read the reports anyway. I really needed, you know, I needed direction, a place to go, but it wasn't exactly what I, you know, what I had thought it would be.
And you were only 17.
17?
Yeah.
Were your was either one of your parents in the military?
No, but my my grandfather was in World War II. Okay. Both of my grandfathers were actually.
Okay. So you you ended up staying in Baghdad for about a year.
Yeah.
And you witnessed some pretty horrible things. Mm. And so the most interesting thing was, to me, or one of the most interesting things about your story is that when you went AWOL, you didn't really even plan to do that.
Were you AWOL in Iraq or when you came back?
No. I left when I came back. There are a number of war resistors I know out there who left from their deployment and never came back. And when they have come back, they face like extensive jail time because mm-hmm. that changes the nature of the crime according to the military.
Right.
But yeah, I I wasn't really ever intending to leave because, you know, you sign a contract and you want to be someone who follows their word. And they drill that into you in the military. And I think a lot of people who join the military are very much like, I'm going to follow my word. I'm going to do good things, whatever. But, you know, we do this oath to swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Right.
And the longer I was in Iraq, like, the more I realized that we weren't really doing anything to defend our own Constitution, you know, to put it basically. I was in intelligence. Like, there are no weapons of mass destruction. The worst that was happening there for weapons was the depleted uranium in southern Iraq. There, most Iraqi women gave birth to children, and the first thing people would ask is it normal? Because there's so many birth defects due to depleted uranium. Right. So many soldiers have symptoms of radiation poisoning, mm-hmm. And sickness. We weren't helping our country over there, like, without a doubt. I kept getting in moderate amounts of trouble for little things. You know, like, I was personally very good at my job. I got an Army Commendation Medal for work I had done. But, you know, like, there's just little people you work with and whatever that would constantly find little things wrong. And, excuse me, then when I got back, I got married. And this evening we had an acting first sergeant, and I had asked him, hey, can my husband and I, after we get married tonight, can we miss PT the next day? He said, yeah, sure, no problem. Just come in at 9:30. And we came in at 9:30, and there was a new person in charge who currently couldn't even be bothered to find the person we'd talked to the day before. And he was going to, you know, give us an Article 15 and all this stuff. And, you know, it wasn't because of that that we directly left. But I remember sitting there that morning, mopping the floors, thinking about all the work I'd done in Iraq, thinking about my friends who had died. And it was really kind of the icing on the cake to all of that, to... I was going to get demoted in rank and punished the day after we get married because people couldn't be bothered to communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there's people dying. Like, so I decided I was going to leave and go about my life without the military and go about and, you know, maybe I could actually try, if I wasn't in the military, to uphold the vows that I took as a soldier, because it certainly wasn't what I thought I would be in, you know, like, I wasn't able to uphold those vows while I was in, so.
But you were kind of, it's almost like you were kind of shoved into that situation, mm-hmm. by them, and then you kind of, and then you just took that to the next step.
Yeah, I mean.
Because they were already pushing you anyway.
Yeah, and yeah. You know, I missed it, but why were they coming after you? I mean, we've talked to so many, mm-hmm. vet guys and women from being in Iraq, you know, about, you know, their decisions to leave and not do that. And why did they pick on you?
Well, okay, so for example, like, in Iraq, there was this one female major who, like, our job was to, our little section, we each prepared a portion of the battle update briefing for the general.
Right, right.
And I don't know quite what hers was, but mine didn't take me that long to, like, go through the significant activity reports and count up bodies. And so I would usually have that done fairly early on in a 12-hour shift.
12 hours.
And I would, because it's just all the reports from the previous 12 hours. There's no new ones during that time period that I need to deal with. So I would have my stuff done, and I was in college. I would work on some college stuff, or I would read a book. You know, and I had other little projects I worked on, but she never had her briefing done on time in the morning. It was like, mm-hmm. we're always waiting on her. And I think she'd just look over and see me not doing anything and blame me for it. But our jobs weren't related. They mm-hmm. weren't connected whatsoever. We always had to help her with using the computer stuff and whatever. And so she kind of, you know, would always file these little complaints about me. And that was, like, just one person. I had a first sergeant tell me that I was too smart to be in intelligence work.
Yeah, I like the old saying, military mm-hmm. intelligence, like an oxymoron.
It's an oxymoron, you know? Right. When he yelled at me and told me I was too smart for intelligence work, I was like, man, you're something else. I thought that was just a joke. Mm-hmm. And it didn't help that what they had done was our company first sergeant was a drill sergeant for the military intelligence school that almost everyone in the unit had came from. And he had been, like, everyone in the unit's drill sergeant. And so he kind of treated us like we were still a bunch of idiots.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which I don't want to sit there and complain, like, oh, the military treated me like shit, so I left. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't really... It was definitely a little different than if it had been some, like, cush intel post or whatever.
Right, right. Well, that's good. And so the whole... Go ahead. I just lost my train of thought.
Oh. Well, we can just keep going. You ended up leaving in January 2007.
Yeah, the day after I got married.
From Fort Hood.
Yes.
And... where did you go? What did you do?
Yeah, so, what did you do?
So we really had no idea what we were going to do at first, but we were both intelligence, so we...
Okay, that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah, we were both in intelligence, so we packed up everything and we went to Houston, which is where my ex-husband's dad lived. Mm-hmm. So we're like, they're not going to find us in Houston. We didn't know how hard the military would look, so we turned off our cell phones and like, took the battery us out and stuff. And we're really... they didn't care that much.
No, they don't.
Because, as a side note, they didn't issue a warrant for our arrest until 2010.
Wow. And what year did you leave?
January 2007. Wow.
3 years later?
Yeah. AWO so
loose. Three years later?
Right. They didn't even issue a warrant. And, of course, like, our parents were all very worried. My ex-husband's mother actually got in contact with some people through a blog that a service member named Ron Cantu had been writing. He was an active duty resistor, and he wrote a lot about active duty resistance, and she connected us with Iraq Veterans Against the War, and a couple other women, like Daryl Anderson was the first active duty war resistor to return from Canada, and I'm good friends with his mother. Like, she helped us out a lot, and we ended up going to Oklahoma City and got jobs and lived there for a while. Mm-hmm. And then I started doing finished carpentry. And we did we worked on this chain of luxury retirement homes, and we did finished carpentry across the nation, which led us to Kennebunkport, Maine. In August 2007, there was an Iraq Veterans Against the War protest in front of, like, the Bush family summer home.
It's her home.
Yeah, and I ended up signing up for IVAW there with my ex-husband and actually some old other members. So, yeah, and I was a part of IVAW since then. Mm-hmm. And as I traveled around the country doing finished carpentry, I'd meet up with other veterans. And, like, I lived in Seattle for quite a while. And
were you surprised to find how many other veterans were out there?
How many? Yeah, AWOL veterans. Like
you, well, it's funny because I still, like, over time, I've ran into a lot of other AWOL war resistors. There's a number of them in Canada. But what's been almost more of a relief is just meeting other veterans that you can talk to about how you feel, and you don't get called, like, a coward or a traitor or whatever, and you know you're not the only one.
So you got called traitor?
Well, a lot of, you know, there's, like, the pro-right, the mill bloggers, whatever. But, you know, like, you have this feeling if you...
Is that what Oath Keepers is?
I'm not familiar with Oath Keepers.
I think it's, like, kind of a right-wing patriot movement type veteran organization.
I know that when we did Winter Soldier...
Winter Soldier in Seattle?
Well, Seattle's Winter Soldier was the largest... local Winter Soldier, but we did the main one in Silver Springs, Maryland in 2008.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I remember.
Yeah, when we did that, there were a lot of anti-US mill bloggers, military bloggers who were present.
Well, talk about that. I never heard of that. Do you know anything about it?
Mm-mm.
So what are you talking about?
The mill bloggers?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you get websites. Like, I don't even want to say the name of the blogs because I don't want to support them.
Don't say the name of the blog.
Because they're kind of jerks.
Don't give them anything.
They spend a lot of their time blogging about the reactionary socialist communists in organizations like Iraq Veterans Against the War, you know, because we have different views. Like, we're obviously cowards or I don't even know why socialist is a dirty word, but
it's not.
But, you know, they spend a lot of time reacting against that. And they kind of colored, you know, in a lot of ways, views I had originally of like going into like a VFW or something, mm-hmm. and being afraid that people would, you know, want to talk a bunch of crap.
Because
even someone who isn't a war resistor, who didn't go AWOL, but shares the same views,
mm-hmm.
You know, can be a little afraid to be looked down upon by like our old battle buddies or whatever.
Right.
But I found it like every Vietnam vet I've talked to seems to be very supportive of like me personally and against like the Iraq war and everything. So,
that's true. A lot of Vietnam vets definitely were against the war in Iraq, mm-hmm. and I don't see why they would be in support. But the same thing happened to me when I remember coming back from Vietnam and I went into a VFW, you know, and I was sitting there and there was these older, like, you know, World War II and Korean War veterans are all sitting there and everything. And then, what were you in? I was in Vietnam. And then it started.
What did they say?
Oh, you bunch of cowards, you bunch of crybabies. You've lost the first American war ever. And you're a bunch of crybabies. And
that's just like something you'd hear on a football team.
Yeah. I mean, I just sat there and I just looked at these guys and I just... what's wrong with you, you know? And so I just decided, well, you know, I can't hang around you guys. And so I just left. But that's how they felt towards Vietnam vets for a long time. A long time they felt that way about us. You know, now that all those guys are dying off, they're wanting Vietnam vets to become part of the VFW, you know, in American
Legion. Well, they're starting to realize
they're dwindling. They're dwindling down. So you were married before you went.
Well, literally one day before I went AWOL, I got married.
Are you still married?
No.
Oh, you got divorced.
No, we got divorced in like 2009.
Oh, that's why I didn't. You got married after you got back.
After I got back from Iraq, yes, but before I went AWOL.
Before you went AWOL.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Was your husband AWOL?
Yes.
Both of you are AWOL?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, it was our honeymoon.
What a great honeymoon.
Yeah.
You're listening to Veterans Voice on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland with Mr. Bill and Angie and myself, and we're talking to Sarah Bining about her time in Iraq and how that's led her on this really interesting trail of kind of interesting about what her life is like now. And so I was going to ask you another question about when you were in Iraq, was there a lot of dissent in your company?
You know, I actually had a sergeant in E5 who I had been talking to about the legality of the war we were in. I had been reading Tolstoy's The Kingdom of God is Within You, just his kind of a long, drawn-out plea to Russian soldiers to not fight in wars. And he was actually very religious, very Christian, the sergeant I was talking to. And I was surprised one day to find he had actually... there was a big to-do because he had left his weapon in his room and refused to carry it. And they were, you know, putting all sorts of threats against him, like, we'll send you outside the wire on patrol and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, I won't take my weapon. Mm-hmm. I won't. So, I mean, there's, like, some major acts of defiance within the unit.
You ended up going quite a long time before anything happened.
Yeah. So... they apparently didn't even issue a warrant until 2010. And it wasn't until... actually, in 2010, my ex-husband got arrested, and he was taken back to Fort Carson and held there for 3 months while they processed him and gave him his discharge.
What kind of discharge did they give?
It was other than honorable, which is still actually upgradable. Like, you can upgrade that and get benefits with it. But they gave him an other than honorable. And then on September 11th, 2013...
just happened to be September 11th.
Yeah, it just happened to be. I was picked up at it was a speeding ticket, and I ended up getting arrested and then sent out from county lockup with orders to report to Fort Carson, and they even gave me a plane ticket.
Yeah, and that's just so crazy.
Yeah.
So you got you got a speeding ticket. They saw you had a warrant.
Yeah, finally.
And then they put you in jail, and you were kept there until you got a plane ticket.
Yeah, I was there for about 12 hours just waiting. And I was actually sent. I got back to Fort Carson on September 13th, 2013. And I waited there for almost an entire year where I was not charged. I have a 5-year-old child, and they would consistently threaten to confine me to post and have CPS take her away just to kind of keep me in line. But they really, I went from being an intelligence analyst to a year of mopping floors, filing papers, and being told I was allowed to do something and then getting in trouble for doing it the next day. They're really like building their case against me. And myself and my lawyer were told explicitly that because I was an anti-war activist, that the best they could offer me would be a year in jail. It had nothing to do with precedent or how they treated other AWOL returns in any way, but it's because I was a vocal anti-war activist.
So you were sent back to the 4th Infantry Division in
right,
Fort Carson.
At Fort Carson.
And then there were 3 other AWOL returns. You said
that were there that all took a year to be processed. There was one guy that they he didn't even know he was AWOL because he had gotten arrested when he had sold drugs to a cop like over 10 years ago, and he served 3 years in jail. And his unit told him he was out of the military. They knew he was in jail. They even came and visited him, and he about a year or so ago was driving to meet his girlfriend after her mother had died, her grandmother, and he got pulled over for speeding and was arrested and sent to wait at Fort Carson for a year for being AWOL.
Wow.
When it was the military's own paperwork mess up anyway.
So
a year.
That
wow.
is so weird that you were gone for so long. You were
7 years,
separated.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're back on a military base and you're active duty again?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, really? So you were gone how long?
7 years.
You were gone 7 years?
Yeah.
And how did they catch you? Did you
a speeding
talk
ticket.
About how they caught you?
It was a speeding ticket, yeah.
A speeding ticket?
Mm-hmm.
So there was a speeding ticket, they got you. Did they arrest you right then?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was actually September 11th, 2013. Yeah.
And so they arrested you and they took you back to the jail.
Mm-hmm.
And then a military came and got you.
No, that's the funny part. They released me on my own recognizance with a plane ticket to go to Fort Carson. I think the best part was when I got to Fort Carson, I had a friend pick me up at Colorado Springs Airport, mm-hmm. and he drove me on a base, and he's like, I feel like a jerk,
yeah.
I'm turning you in, because he's a veteran too. But I walk into the MP station, and I tell them I'm there, they have me wait in the waiting room for 45 minutes, and then they bring me into the back and handcuff me to a bench.
Wow.
Okay.
Let's got to follow procedure.
Yeah.
Just standard operating procedure.
Standing operating procedure.
Yeah.
So they gave you a ticket. You mm-hmm. flew down there after 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
7 years.
And they welcomed you with open arms.
Oh, they were so happy to have another janitor.
So did they make you wear a uniform?
Oh, yeah. Like, I had to buy my uniform.
Yeah.
Some of the people in the unit were kind of nice, and they helped me, because I was like, I don't want to buy another military uniform.
I don't want to buy anything.
I'm done with this.
You're right.
But, they helped me get a uniform. I got one after like a month and a half. I finally had one. And that was really weird to put that back on.
Oh, yeah. Horrible.
It was more like, I think, traumatizing than I imagined it would be.
Right.
And it was all very, very surreal.
What did they have you doing?
Mopping floors.
I mean, they didn't
papers.
Put you like in a stockade or anything.
No,
they
no.
put you in a barracks.
No, I lived off post.
Yeah. Why don't they just leave you alone?
I know.
No bars on the windows.
I lived off post, and I got paid. But
you got thing. Paid.
Yeah. But this is the thing, because I was active duty, right? I can't get not paid until I get charged and put away. The military is wasting, I don't know how many thousands of dollars playing this game with AWOL soldiers.
Right.
Where, like, Sarah Lazar wrote an article in 2009 about it, about how the military, as, like, part of the punishment, will hold AWOL soldiers for like a year or more without charging them.
Right.
But they pay us the whole time.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if you'd think all AWOL soldiers should go to jail for being total jerks, it's a waste of money for the government to keep paying us for a year or more before they punish us.
Oh, that's so funny. Really? 7 years, you go back, they let you live, they let you fly back, you live off base, mm-hmm. they pay you, you go back to the post every day. Mm-hmm. That is just, I never heard anything. But you know what the military, after Vietnam, I don't know if they still do it, for AWOL and deserter guys, they would just convenience of the government, COG, convenience of the government, discharge them.
They should do that.
It was it was a less than honorable, mm-hmm. you know, but, you know, it wasn't all this crap. You know, right. These guys wouldn't have to, you know, get arrested and have to do like you did and be you know, done like that.
Well, active duty is very different than Reserve and National Guard also.
Right.
I know personally a number of Reserve and National Guard soldiers that went AWOL by just, they stopped showing up to drill. Right. And after a year or so, they got a letter saying they were discharged.
Yeah, yeah.
Which seemed like what you're talking
that
about.
That would be the best thing to do. Right. But these guys were like active duty guys. Mm-hmm. In Vietnam, they just said, I'm not doing it anymore. And I never knew anybody in Vietnam who ever went AWOL, I don't think. But I knew some guys that after they came back, you know, they still had like a year left or something in the military, that those guys would go home on leave and they just wouldn't come back. Right. And so that happened a lot. But to, this seems crazy to me.
What happened to your rank?
Rank. What rank were you when you were actually active duty?
Well, I was a specialist.
Spec 4?
Spec
4?
I had gotten E4. An Article 15 while I was in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And so I was a E3, a PFC, right. And when I came back, I stayed a PFC.
They
wouldn't take my rank until they charged me.
But right, they charge you, right.
They'd have to actually charge me for something.
So how long were you actually in Fort Carson?
I was there until a couple weeks ago, actually. A
couple weeks ago?
Yeah.
So they held you, they were holding you there that long without charging you.
Yes.
Are you discharged now?
No.
She's AWOL.
Yeah.
You're AWO loose?
Still, yes. because, you know, it came down to between threatening me with regarding my child and then saying that they were going to put me in jail because I'm an active, like a vocal anti-war activist.
Right.
I said, you know what, fine. I'll go and be a vocal anti-war activist. Mm-hmm. And when you catch up with me again, then we can go back and do the jail thing.
Right.
But then everyone will know exactly why, you know, I'm going to jail or why you're putting me in jail.
Right.
And I'm going to be working on my conscientious objector packet in the meantime.
Right. Well, what about your ex-husband? Is he still on the run? Still loose?
No. He got picked up in 2010, and he was only there for 3 months.
And then they just
they gave him an other than honorable discharge.
Right, other than honorable discharge.
Mm-hmm.
But not you.
No.
Not you, because you're probably your position with IVAW.
Yeah.
So did they know that you were part of IVAW?
Oh, yeah.
They knew that.
It is within the military's technical capacity to Google me.
Yeah.
So they had done that.
So you had a child while you were captive by the military.
I had a daughter in September of 2008, and so she was. I had to come back to Fort Carson the day before her 5th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
I had to miss that, and I was able to bring her back out with me 6 weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
She had a lot of adjustment trouble.
Right.
She didn't really know why I'd been gone, and it was all sudden. So
were you getting? You were getting your base pay,
mm-hmm.
and you were getting
base pay with dependents.
With dependents, and plus living off base, you were getting ration stuff.
Right.
And so, gee, that'd be better if they just discharged you.
Yeah.
Discharged you.
Absolutely.
Well, I'd have stayed.
Yeah, she stayed and got, because probably they did. Was there any idea how long you would have been before they would have actually charged you? Was there any?
No.
Did you ever talk to an attorney?
I had an attorney that was representing me pro bono. But I never got to talk to the trial defense people or JAG or anyone.
Yeah, JAG. You never talked to any of those people. And so they just had you kind of like a laborer.
Yeah, and I had been, I was supposed to graduate college with my bachelor's in writing and publication. this last May, and I couldn't do that because I was interrupted again by the military.
Right.
I've never used any of my benefits. I've never used the GI Bill, whatever. So all my college is out of my own pocket, not the military's pocket.
Right.
And I also managed a university writing center.
Oh, good.
I was a contributing
public servant
type.
So when Angie said that you were part of the Iraqi Veterans Against the Wars.
It's the board.
Yeah, board. Talk about that.
Well, I just, I've been on the board of directors. Iraq Veterans Against the War is a national 501(c) nonprofit or direct action anti-war veterans group. And I had decided to serve on the board starting in 2010 because I thought it would be a really good way to help out this organization that I cared about and help out, you know, anti-war effort, help with reparations for the Iraqi people, without being, this is funny, but without being a super vocal anti-war activist, because
right.
I had followed other AWOLs, and when it was a big political case, then all of a sudden it was jail and whatever.
Right.
So I was trying to serve behind the scenes to help the organization out.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been on the board since 2010, basically.
Really?
And I became chair of the board, I think, earlier this year.
Mm-hmm. So does IVAW keep track of AWOLs and deserters?
We work with organizations like Courage to Resist and War Resisters League.
Right.
Like IVAW in and of itself. Like, I mean, we don't keep like a list.
Right.
But definitely, there's a number of war resistors in the organization. People have left at different times for different reasons,
mm-hmm.
and they're all supported in IVAW mm-hmm. with different ways. Either it can just be emotionally,
right,
from all the way to like fundraising.
Right.
We've helped some more high profile, like Lieutenant Aaron Watada.
Oh, Watada, wonderful guy. Mm-hmm. Wonderful guy.
Yeah,
he had to be was Watada the highest ranking guy to go AWOL to refuse to serve?
I think that we know of, right?
I can't think.
I think that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I can't think of anybody in a higher rank than him that ever.
Yeah, no,
did.
He'd be like the highest ranking one that we know of, because there was over 40,000 service members went AWOL between 2001 and 2010.
40,000?
Yes.
AWOLs?
Yeah.
That sounds like Vietnam numbers.
They don't want to talk about it.
That sounds like Vietnam numbers, because Vietnam had a huge, you know, AWOL and deserter rate, just huge.
Right, and I think part of that, we've talked before in IVAW about like what would it look like if we reinstituted the draft, because then it would matter to everyone,
right?
And then people would care. But that's why I think the Vietnam numbers got more publicity because it affected.
Yeah. Do you know Brian Wilson? Brian Wilson, the
Beach Boys.
No. Brian Wilson, the VBAW and Veterans for Peace, who got his legs cut off.
I don't know.
You haven't met him. You should meet him. He's our good buddy, and he lives here in Portland now. He's a wonderful guy.
Yeah.
He's a great guy. And
I bet you he's listening right now.
Yeah, I bet he is, Brian. He's our buddy, and he's a really good guy that said years ago, he told us, he says, we got to get the draft.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, if we need the draft, we need the draft to get people to understand what's going on, because people don't care.
Right.
Because they don't have any flesh in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And Brian has always said that. And I remember people saying, no, we don't want to do that. We don't want to do that. But Brian always stuck to that gun. He always said, you know, they need the draft. The draft will end this madness right now. Because most of the people in the military...
It's a poverty draft.
It's a poverty draft.
Called the economic draft.
Right.
Charlie Rangel proposed to reinstate the draft.
Yes, he did. Charlie Rangel said that. But it is it's a economic draft. It's a poor people's draft. So you get these folks in. I can't believe that the military that the active duty military folks really support the war in Iraq. I just can't imagine they go back four or five times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they go back to Afghanistan all these times. And I just can't imagine them really supporting the war.
I kind of look at it in a lot of ways when I run into other post-9/11 veterans who support, like, particularly the war in Iraq, but also in Afghanistan. I get the sense that for a lot of them, it's almost a coping mechanism. You know, like, if I'm against this war, if I admit this is a bunch of crap, then it means my buddies died for nothing.
Right.
And I understand that, but I think it's more important to turn around and make those deaths mean something by
once you start
speaking out.
Yeah. Well, and once you start questioning, like, what actually is going on, once you start thinking about the reality of what things are actually happening, what the consequences of war are, then you open up a whole nother topic that completely overturns everything that you thought you knew about patriotism and war.
Yeah. When you were in, Angie, what was, you were on a ship, right? You were on a
ship. I was on the Cowpens.
Yeah. So what was the feeling of those folks?
Most of the being deployed or just in general?
Yeah, in general.
And there was a few people that, and mostly officers that were a little bit gung-ho about things, but most of the people, I think, were just maintaining a life. I think that most of the people that I served with were, one, either trying to work their way out of poverty, or two, they were trying to just maintain a career and maintain a paycheck and just keep kind of moving along without seemingly much direction in life, just doing the nuts and bolts of what a job includes in the Navy. I didn't think that people seemed too incredibly enthusiastic about everything, but things functioned, and I feel like it was just a little bit of a droning along type of daily grind routine.
Yeah, it would be a daily grind. So how about the people in on the ship? Was there I can't imagine there being a lot of reenlistments.
The enlistment rate was relatively low. There were not that many people reenlisting. There were some people that would transfer into other branches.
Really?
Yeah, sometimes. And usually that wasn't very common. I remember when I was leaving, I remember hearing a conversation about how low the reenlistment rate actually was for the Navy at that time. But I got out in 2005.
Right.
So.
Right. So I can imagine that the enlistment rate right now is pretty low. Well, they're letting people out.
They're doing a huge drawdown.
Yeah, they're doing a drawdown.
They actually made it. They reduced the tattoo rules. Like, you can't have tattoos below your elbows if you want to get promoted. Right. And they had. You know, they're doing all these little things to get people out. Yeah, and making it harder to get in.
In fact, I just heard that they're rifting out guys, majors. Mm-hmm. They're rifting majors out.
Yep.
Captains.
Yeah.
You know, and lower lieutenants, first and second lieutenants, they're just getting rid of them. Just getting rid of them because
the thing
they're drawing down.
The thing that troubles me about that is the fact that they're putting more resources into special operations.
Right.
See, it seems like a good idea to draw down the military, and then we have more money being used for special operations and things that are under the radar.
Right.
Below the Geneva Conventions, they're not in the newspapers, nobody knows about them.
See, that bothers me a lot, too.
Get rid of a major and buy a drone.
Yeah. Well, not just that. They can use all these non-military guys to go do the dirty work that they wouldn't, you know, the military can't do.
Blackwater
and all those, because, you know, that's going to be a problem.
But, you know, what's really dangerous is, I mean, it's coming home right now with, like, Ferguson, but we have these hugely inflated military contracts and defense spending.
Yes.
And they do their sell-offs of everything, right, of military equipment to these small municipal police forces. And what people also don't realize is that those police forces are required to use that equipment within a year of getting it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's the 1033.
Really,
they're required
to use it within
that
short period of time. Mm-hmm. I just heard this morning that they talked to a full bird colonel or something at the Pentagon was justifying selling that stuff to police departments. Mm-hmm.
They don't sell it, I don't think.
Oh, they sell it. Homeland Security sells it, too. And he was saying that it was good for business, basically, because all these companies came around during the wars to build this stuff for the military to buy it. So they're supporting these little companies by the military giving them money and Homeland Security. Mm. And Homeland Security gives them money, but they have to use that money to buy surplus equipment from the military. And so, I don't know about you guys, but when I was getting out of the military, there were police recruiters. Discharge places that were just handing this thing. I said, "Do you want to be in a police department?" They were, you know, just hiring all kinds of grunts, infantry guys, you know, that were in, had been in the service. They wanted
really funny guys. That you would say that, because when I enlisted, there's an option that I selected on my contract to go directly into State Patrol.
Oh yeah. My goodness!
Yeah, after getting
how
out.
How you feel about that now?
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
I don't think they want me. Yeah. But yeah,
your job options are getting thin here.
You were just left a couple weeks ago,
right?
And so, how do you feel now?
You know, it's funny. It's like a relief, because I tried for another year, you know, to play the game.
Just didn't work.
And I have PTSD.
Sure you do.
Lots of issues, like we all do, right? And I tried really hard to play their game, and it was, you know, it's just not okay. It's not okay what we're doing overseas. It's not okay to support militarism, and, you know, which we're seeing a lot now. It's kind of funny that we're bombing Iraq again.
Again.
People don't know what militarism is, but all of a sudden they're learning because of Ferguson, understanding how we have this hugely militarized police force, and that's one of the effects of militarism across the globe. Right. And I can't be a part of that system.
Good for you.
So, you know, it's almost like, as sad as it is, the world's reinforcing my decision.
Right.
Well, so what about those bases that they were supposed to have built in Iraq? 15 or 16 bases?
Right.
And they built an elaborate embassy there. Mm-hmm. Have you been to the embassy?
I haven't been to the embassy, but I was part of the Victory Base Complex.
That's huge.
And so, yeah, it's gigantic. We were, in 2006 when I left, we were building tons of, like, cement, structures, like barracks and permanent buildings, which I always thought was really funny if we were going to pull out.
Yeah, if we're going to pull out. And that seems kind of funny.
Yeah, and so it wasn't really, it didn't really surprise me too much to hear about us going back in.
Yeah, we never had any intention of leaving anyway.
I don't think so.
Oh, I don't think they had either. We're just about out of time, and this has been very interesting.
Wish we had another hour.
Yeah, I wish we did. Yeah. And we've been talking to Sarah Bining, and she's part of Iraqi Veterans Against the War Board of Directors. And she's been talking about what she did in the military and why she left the military. And pretty good reasons, I think, to leave the military. And Tammy, we're just about done here. And we'll be back on September 19th, 9 a.m. And this is Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, Oregon. And Sarah, thank you.
Thank you very much,
Thank
Sarah.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And there it is.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British War. Young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with formation in the Japanese skies. Set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't a marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant.
210 days of school until next vacation.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Washington Gorge Action Program's Back to School fundraiser August 23rd from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Columbia Gorge Interpretive Center, 990 Rock Creek Drive in Stevenson, Washington. There will be a fashion show, live music, a silent auction, and dessert social. Washington Gorge Action Programs is a multi-purpose human service organization dedicated to helping individuals, families, and communities address basic human needs. Again, that's the Washington Gorge Action Program's Back to School fundraiser, August 23rd at the Columbia Gorge Interpretive Center, 990 Rock Creek Drive in Stevenson, Washington. More information about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10 a.m. Coming up, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre, followed at 10:15 with Flashpoints, and at 11 with the Radio Zine. So keep it locked right here, 90.7 FM, your community radio.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, August 15th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. We're going to try to speak again and continue our conversation from yesterday with Sami Rasuli on the situation in Iraq and why we seem to know so much about so many other groups. The U.S. mainstream media never stops talking about Hamas, or for that matter, Hezbollah, or for that matter, the various warring parties.